talks about uncertain futures, which is one of the recurring theme I think we have heard so much today. And the first speaker is Moa Nyambati. She just submitted her PhD thesis in social work at the Institute of Trondheim, and she is actually defending her thesis next month. And her thesis talk. Unaccompanied minors traveling from Greece to Europe.
First of all, I want to thank the organizing committee for inviting me, and it's been such an inspiring day, and I feel really privileged to be here. My thesis is called Fragmented Journeys, Social Relations and Age Amongst Afghan Young People on the Move Towards Europe, Positioning, Negotiating, and Redefining. And my study is sought to participate in the intellectual debate on journeys. And it looks at journeys as a part of the migration process worth investigating, given their potentially significant temporal and experiential nature. And by choosing a case study where those migrating are young, age also becomes of central relevance in understanding such journeys and accompanying transitions. And today I will present some of my findings on the journeys and on age. So my study has been inspired by and engages with a wide range of literature, several of which is by others here today. In regards to the focus on the journeys and on age, I've grouped it into six themes, but several of these can be included across the themes. So literature and journeys, including their transformative power, and social status change through journeys and pilgrimage practices. Literature and journeys as construct, process, and narrative, looking at the symbolism attached to journeys and the role of imagined and anticipated movement. Literature on transit migration, fragmented journeys, and irregular migration. Literature on unaccompanied minors on the move to the West, looking at young people migrating to new socio-cultural contexts and often at the margins of society. Literature on young adulthood and transition to adulthood and legal status, and literature on post-deportation as related to Afghanistan. The research questions that I've sought to answer in my study were, how can we understand the experiences of the journeys and coping strategies of Afghan young people on the move towards Europe, and how is this affected by social relations and by age? And social relations, first and foremost, concern other Afghans mentoring the journeys, other Afghans on the move, but also Afghans randomly encountered, those they're traveling with, and so forth. And age becomes important as all of my main respondents embarked on their journeys towards Europe as unaccompanied minors. So the focus is very much on the young people's everyday experiences and interactions and the negotiation of the structural frames they encounter. So it's on the complexity of lived experiences. And I focus on Afghans as they represent the largest group of unaccompanied minors arriving in Europe for several years. So in order to answer the research questions, I designed my project as multi-sited and multi-method. I conducted research in Norway, representing a country where my respondents sought to remain, and Greece, a country where they sought to transit. I did 7 months of fieldwork in Greece, Italy, and Turkey. Five of these months were in the Greek port city of Patra, which is the city that has the largest port connecting Greece and Italy. My methods were life history and semi-structured interviews, ethnographic fieldwork, and creative methods, including photo diaries, written diaries, drawings, poems, graffiti, and other written segments. And some of these you'll also see as part of the presentation, like the first slide was a drawing by a young Afghan in Patra. And I chose these various methods to have different entry points to the young people's experiences and try to adopt a sensitive and flexible approach in our encounters. So briefly about my main respondents, all were males between the ages of 15 and 24 at the time of participation. I had 23 respondents in Norway. They had arrived between 2008 and 2014, and all but one was an unaccompanied minor upon arrival. 17 of these had been granted asylum and 6 were rejected asylum seekers. And then I had 4 main respondents in Greece. They were undocumented young Afghans. And in addition, I spent shorter and longer periods with around 80 young people, including 11 photo diary participants. And I say shorter and longer periods because in the environment that Patra represents, there were always comings and goings. People were making it across to Italy, they would return, they would find themselves in protective custody or in detention. They would travel to other exit points or to Athens or take up a space at a shelter for some time, often to rest, to reflect, or to recuperate from injuries. And Patras, a city, has attracted Afghans for a long time. Until 2009, there was a large informal settlement which was demolished, and it had around 2,000 Afghans. And we're talking about basically only men, boys and men. Around the time of my fieldwork, the population of Afghans was much lower, but they were still the largest group, around 200, 300 potentially. So on to some of my findings. Respondents' journeys were non-linear. They were journeys filled with various setbacks, a continuous search for movement in which the young people generally expressed being very active and of longer and shorter periods of waiting or of immobility. Most of the journeys of respondents in Norway had lasted around 1 year, but the range was between a few months and more than 4 years. But if we look at their lives in a broader perspective, the journeys towards Europe were part of a larger history. So many had spent years in Pakistan and Iran, and some also spoke about the history of migration was extended backwards across generations as they had been born in neighboring countries. And those who had undertaken prior migration positioned their journeys within these broader migration histories. And their narratives often started from such experiences or from the migration experiences of family members. So they related of their journeys towards Europe with reference to multiple experiences of migration and of displacement. I mapped informants' journey trajectories, and I came up with 3 different broad categories. And I want to show you one of the journey trajectories of one of my respondents. So he first traveled to Pakistan and then continued on to Iran after several years, but was deported. He again left for Pakistan, onto Iran, and continues onwards to Europe. He spends 3 years in Greece. He's homeless and is unable to cross the border westward. So he smuggles himself back to Iran. In Iran, he experiences living as undocumented again and experiences another deportation. And he leaves Afghanistan for a third time, this time managing to arrive in Norway. There, his asylum claim is rejected, and at the time of the interview, he was facing forced removal. And looking at this journey in the broader life perspective, it spanned 14 years. For some of my respondents, the multiple and redirection of movement, which characterized their journey trajectories, including crossing multiple state borders and regions, as it did for him. For others, it was much more localized. It could be repeated movement between Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran, or between Greece, Macedonia, and Italy. And it can even be within one country, including multiple potential exit points. And the journey's geographical expanse did not necessarily determine duration. So, for example, one of my respondents traveled from Afghanistan to Pakistan and then Iran 3 times within 1.5 months, while others would spend years just trying to leave Greece. So it was a real range. Encounters with state actors is part of such journeys, and for unaccompanied minors, there are often 2 competing social categories which become salient in their encounters with these. So the categories children and irregular migrants. And the fact that one is a minor has several implications, and for my respondents, implications of age became evident particularly in 2 ways. And this related to physical aspects, which often follow on from young age. So not being able to climb a fence because you're not tall enough, not having the same physical strength as an adult to protect yourself, or in inexperience. And these aspects sometimes also resulted in sympathy from others, as young age also has a symbolic value. But age also became evident in how they were responded to by state actors, and now I'm referring to border guards, police, and child protection structures, and how chronological age had implications for the applicable laws and interventions. So my respondents traveled across 9 to 13 countries, and in 6 countries combined, they were protected as minors by state actors. But it was clear to see that their status as irregular during most of their journeys was something which was emphasized much more than their status as minors. So in 8 countries combined, the young people experienced being jailed or detained. And this could be for a couple of days, it could be for a couple of weeks, but it could also be for several months. Amongst my informants, the longest period was 10 months. It was generally not until Greece that respondents gained an expressed and stated awareness about the significance of chronological age. Before this, they often related of the consequences of age to physical characteristics and lack of skills. And one respondent put it simply. He said, "I didn't know the difference of over 18 or under 18. I learned this in Europe." So relationship to age is reconfigured in the encounter with formal structures, and it intensifies as the young people go through age assessments, the asylum procedure, and potential removal procedures. The significance of age for unaccompanied minors on the move comes into play both in regards to the need to access protection mechanisms and in ensuring onward mobility. And the role that age plays in facilitating these needs can be opposing and contradictory, as depending on the context, greater freedom of movement may be accorded to minors or to adults. My respondents generally negotiated such aspects accordingly. So often they presented themselves as adults upon apprehension of irregular entry or stay in Greece, but later depending on being able to pass as minors in order to gain access to assistance or release from detention. So age and the consequences of this and resulting vulnerability may be contradictory and context dependent, as the transition to legal adulthood reveals, as vulnerability may become intensified as the young people turn legally adult at 18 and become legally deportable. So my respondents were often undocumented during most of their journeys, and several also had prior experiences of undocumentedness from Iran and Pakistan, often over longer time periods. And how they spoke about such experiences often had parallels to experiences of being undocumented along the way. So it included worrying about being apprehended and fearing deportation and detention, living in a marginal and insecure situation, not approaching authorities for protection, and being at risk of exploitation and violence. And sometimes in their narratives, they also compared experiences of this across contexts. And prior experiences of undocumentedness can affect and can even increase ability to cope with such situations, not making it easier, but giving them a reference of what it might entail, and may as such be seen as offering a resource. And it could also affect how undocumented status itself is perceived. But it could also convey a feeling of being unable to escape these aspects and being stuck in a prolonged liminal phase which extends across countries and regions. And this may be experienced as a wasting away, reinforcing previous difficulties and giving a sense of repeatedly not being able to find a solution. And my respondents with rejected asylum claims in Norway often articulated a feeling of wasting away and a sense of utter personal failure, as had they only done something differently, had they stopped in Sweden, in Denmark, or in another country, maybe they would have achieved a different outcome. So structural factors were given importance, but the rejection was also attributed to their own decisions. And there was such an emphasis on what they should have done, what they could have done, and what they would have done. Do I have more time? Yeah? Okay. So Prior experiences of deportation were also not uncommon amongst my respondents. They had often occurred under quite harsh conditions. But respondents facing forced removal expressed a much greater level of anxiety and distress when talking about potential removal from Norway. None of my respondents had opted for voluntary return. They didn't see it as an alternative. Two of my respondents had already experienced return from Europe, and several others had experienced deportation from Pakistan and Iran, but they had all remigrated. And I'm not claiming that this is always the case, but I didn't meet several young people, both in Norway and in Greece, who were on their second journeys towards Europe, and I was told of others who were on their third journeys. And it's also important to remember that for the many Afghans who were born in Pakistan and Iran, their first encounter with Afghanistan might also result from such a deportation. For my respondents with rejected asylum claims, so a total of six, this concerned two young people, and a third had spent 12 years in exile. And of course, this can also affect feelings and willingness towards return and where you have your attachment. So upon arrival to Norway, journeys were redefined into other forms of trajectories beyond physical process. It transformed into a legal trajectory and also more existential ones, with arrival at the sought destination not necessarily entailing an end to the journey, either as physical process or in these other forms. And I think I will leave it at that. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Julia, who I think we should also thank for all your work on organizing today, along with Nandos and Elaine. Thank you for all the back and forth, all your hard work. I have, in a way, the easy job of coming in the last session, because I think a lot of the things I'll say really resonate with everything I've heard today. And I've been focusing for the last 10 years mainly on the return side, so not looking at the perspective of the arriving, of the destination point, but really looking at what happens to people once they return. And over the last 10 years, what I've learned is that, again, repeating what has been said today, we need to look at the whole cycle. So I can't really understand the experience of a returnee if I don't necessarily understand what has happened to them in the journey. So thank you for that. And upon arrival in the UK, which is the Becoming Adults Project. So for me, it really strengthens my work on the return side to have listened to all of you. And I hope some of the elements I'll be introducing today can also be of use to those involved more on the legal aspects here as well. And this has to do with country of origin information reports and others. I'll try to use some of the most recent interviews we've done with my team at Samuel Hall on this issue. So really building on past research with Lisa Schuster on stigma and failure. So I won't repeat some of what you know already, but try to build on what has been published to date and really focus on the precariousness, on the uncertain futures of returnees and looking at how these are really not just political constructs, but also social constructs. So that's what I'll spend the next 15 minutes on. One of the subtitles I wanted to put to my presentation was the missed opportunities to join a global community, and you'll see why. What I want to emphasize today is how much we've spoken about government policies here in Europe, but there's also a very dynamic context at the moment in Afghanistan on the policies of the government, on the policies of the international community, I'm not just talking about the EU-Turkey deal or the joint way forward that has been signed with the Afghan government, which basically opens the door to up to 80,000 returns over the next years to Afghanistan. There are talks about building a new terminal at the Kabul airport just to facilitate the number of returns that have to come from Europe over the next years. So we're talking about a big policy focus there. But what's, I think, very concerning is the fact that the current government's focus has gone towards refugee returns and the whole forced migration side of the conversation, putting migrants to Europe on a different level, meaning more of the economic migrants, the voluntary migrants. And we all know in this room how the forced voluntary dichotomy is a blurred one and a dangerous one, but it really is one that is feeding policy and practice in Afghanistan. There have been over 1 million forced returns over the last year to Afghanistan. So that's mainly from Pakistan, refugees, documented and undocumented deportees from Iran. So within that 1 million people, the returns from Europe, about 10,000, are not a policy priority with a government that doesn't really have the capacity already to take care of all of the returnees from the region. So just putting in perspective, the numbers are important. But also the statements that the president of Afghanistan has made last year to the BBC, saying that he has no sympathy for Afghan migrants, that they should return and stay to rebuild the country. So we're still in 2017 at a time where conflict has risen incredibly throughout Afghanistan. We still have a president that talks about reconstruction of a country. So we're going 15 years back to what the discourse was in 2002 about rebuilding a nation and voting with your feet and coming back and helping rebuild a nation. That's the discourse of the government, very far away from the discourse of Afghans. Also, for your claims and more of your legal work, note that this year the UN actually removed the post label on the post-conflict status of Afghanistan, and that Afghanistan is now recognized by the Humanitarian Affairs Coordination Body, UN OCHA, as a country in conflict. So we have a huge discrepancy in the fact that returnees from Europe don't fit into any of the categories that are seen as the people in need of protection is a huge concern overall. So that's the policy context we're talking about, a policy context that doesn't cater to returnees from Europe. So this leads to the situation of precarity or precariousness, which is an existence that lacks in predictability, in job security, material security, but also psychological welfare. Why I'm using this concept of precarity is because it's an expansive definition. Now, we use it beyond job insecurity, and these are some of the elements in the literature that I use. So really building on the past literature to speak about the uncertainty, to speak about how precarity is also a social construct, very much defined by human beings, not just by policies, and that there is a changing face and treatment of people, and you will see there's a changing face and treatment of Afghan returnees. To substantiate all of this, I use some of the recent research that we've self-funded. So we have an office based in Kabul, and I have wonderful Afghan colleagues, and I'm speaking really on their behalf on the work that they have been doing over the last 2 years with what we've called a longitudinal migration assessment. So basically, this is an effort by four of my Afghan colleagues who live in Kabul, who are themselves also returnees, mainly from the region. They've been interviewing Afghans in transit at destination and upon return every 2 months. So building this conversation by Afghans with Afghans to try to minimize some of the bias that, for example, if I would lead the interviews, would have to build into and factor in. So they've been having these conversations with men and women, youth and non-youth, and here today I'll be focusing on the youth side of the conversation. And the findings from our work has been these questions of uncertainty, which your project highlights, the struggle for autonomy that Afghan youth feel, and the sense of disorientation and entrapment upon return. So I'll take two stories to walk you through our findings. Two stories, and again, there's 35 respondents we've had. But one is Marzia, who's 20, she's Pashtun, and she was born in Iran as a refugee. So she didn't know Afghanistan before she was returned. She's married with two children. She went to school up until the end of her secondary school, but she couldn't go further because Iran didn't allow her to go into her tertiary education. But she's literate, she's educated, she got married, and they decided together, after having two children, they decided, the four of them, to leave Iran and to go to Europe. They got separated along the way. Her husband got deported with a child. She continued all the way to Germany, submitted an asylum claim, and we'll see how under pressure she actually returned back to Iran. Mohammed is 21. He's Tajik. He was born in Ghor in Afghanistan. He left relatives behind with a huge sense of mental guilt and against his family's will, because he saw it as his responsibility to go to Europe to improve the well-being of his entire family. He did not know about the legal procedures in Germany, did not follow the rules like he was supposed to, and found himself out of the legal structure in Germany. And I'll walk you through his story. So these are the two stories that we'll go through today. First, on this question of uncertainty and transitions to adulthood, the hope that both Marzia and Mohammed shared is that the exclusion that they felt in Iran, so if you read Marzia's quote, you'll see that she was excluded from work, that her children were excluded from school, that they were all excluded from having a refugee status. They didn't have a card or a legal status in Iran. And her husband was excluded from having any healthcare. So there were all these layers. And again, that's where we can't talk about push and pull factors, or continuous layers of protection issues that they were facing. Mohammed had other issues, but for both of them, the exclusion was one that they wanted to flee. So going to Europe was a way to flee this exclusion from rights in Iran, or the exclusion, for example, from having a decent life in Afghanistan. So this uncertainty hit them as individuals, but very much the family discourse was present in the choices they made. The mother, the parents, the children, they were acting on all of their behalf by migrating. At the same time, for them, migration was a journey that was also very individualistic. They were on their own when they were traveling. As we saw, Marzia was separated from her family, and Mohammed left on his own. So there was a real struggle for autonomy at the heart of their journey, which in a way was actually limited by their family connections. We spoke today about the fact that having links, connections with families and friends in Europe can actually act against you. In this situation, for our two respondents, they realized a bit too late that their family ties actually made them lose opportunities that they would have access to in Europe. For example, for Mohammed, when he arrived in Austria, he connected immediately with his family, which left him outside of the refugee camp system in Australia. He spent too much time at his family's house, which made him ineligible to actually being taken care of in a camp setting, and which made him ineligible to the asylum system. And he got basically taken off a list where he could have had assistance because he relied on his family. For Marzia, she was separated from her family. And because of that, because her husband and her daughter got deported, and because her husband actually threatened her if she didn't join him back. So he was deported back to Iran, and instead of telling her, go ahead and make it for the rest of us, he told her, if you don't come back, I'll divorce you. And if you don't come back, you won't have access to your child anymore. So because of her family, she was actually pulled back through the migration journey back to Afghanistan and Iran. So they both actually had to return and decided to return. They weren't technically deported. They signed up to voluntarily return, but as a construct by their family, pushed by their family. When they returned to Afghanistan, they faced a life of restriction. And the questions that they posed to us were, you know, what is left for me? Who have I become? Who am I? We met them in Afghanistan, and both of them actually quickly left to go to Iran. So the whole remigration that we know post-return. In the case of Mohammed, he went to Iran to earn a living. and he's been arrested multiple times by the police. He's managed to have a permit to be there and to not be deported from Iran, but he cannot go out from his area. So there is this feeling of a restriction on his mobility, on his rights. For Marzia, her children are out of school, which was, again, as you remember, one of the reasons why she wanted to migrate was to have a better education for her kids. So she comes back to a situation where her children haven't gained from her migration or from her return, and she has domestic problems. And where it's actually quite useful to have had these conversations every 2 months with Marzia is we saw how long it took for her husband to actually speak to her again after return. Her husband and her first child have a permit to reside in Iran. She and the second child don't. So she's actually clustered in her home. She can't leave her home setting. So she went from a situation where she applied for asylum in Germany, and as the counselors had told her, she could have made it. She would have probably had her asylum claim approved, but her husband basically asked her to come back. And now in Iran, the power dynamic in the family has completely changed, whereas he can leave work informally, and she can't even leave her home, because if she does, she can get arrested and deported back to Afghanistan. So for her, the restrictions are not only about rights, but also about her voice in her family and the power dynamics with her own husband. And these are, again, we're talking about people who are 20 and 21 to date and who left when they were even younger. So the layers of problems through the journey and upon return lead to these restrictions and to this precarity upon return. And this got me thinking, and I was reading Butler's book on precarious life, and the quote above really made me think about our collective responsibility as well. But Butler says, our collective responsibility as part of an international community requires that we ask about how those conditions came about. And really to understand return, we have to ask what the conditions were throughout the journey upon arrival, and what the political constructs, for example, the legal procedures that Mohammed didn't know in Austria, or the legal procedures upon return, the lack of assistance upon return for any of them in Afghanistan, really led to all these mechanisms and steps of exclusion across all of the stages of their migration. And their families have led to this exclusion to a great extent. The legal procedures have led them. So it's both a social and political construct of exclusion that youth, young people, have to live with upon return. So what we have to think about as scholars is how these practices of exclusion amount to a sort of an apparatus, and our obligation to denounce some of these measures of exclusions, how the labels refugees, economic migrants, exclude them from certain assistance, how the policy context in Afghanistan and the EU deals with the Afghan government leads to exclusion, but also how the social constructs and the lack of support that migrants have lead them to feeling excluded all the way back to their homes. So there is a clear gap in assistance, and the interesting aspect is that Mohammed was, you know, sharp and quick to identify the fact that the UN was never, for example, present for him when he was in Europe. He was never guided to understand the legal steps. But as soon as he decided to return, within 2 weeks, the return process, the tickets, everything was arranged, and he was quickly returned home. And upon return, he reflected on that and thought how ironical it was that it took him so long to get there. And then so quickly, once he had decided to return, the return was efficiently organized for him. And Marzia highlighted the gap in mentoring and using very strong words about feeling like a prisoner because she's living in a camp and she can't leave her home. Her husband has documents, she doesn't. So she definitely feels the tensions now all the way into her home setting. And so we'll be following her and her experiences of return and the experiences of return of the others we've spoken with. But I did want you to reflect on this collective responsibility that we have to really reflect on post-return outcomes. And as always, one of the key issues that I keep emphasizing is there is a lot of evidence on what happens post-return. We've built a lot of that evidence. Consult us if you need some of that to build any of your cases or any of your efforts to support those who are threatened to be deported. I know Jenny and I have collaborated and it's worked in the past. So hopefully we can all work together more to connect the dots from origin to return. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon. We're coming nearly to an end. You're speaking to no researchers. I'm not a researcher. Don't expect me to talk with the language of a researcher. But I'll speak from my heart, from what I've seen on the past 5 years happening to our looked-after children. Shpresa means hope in Albanian language and was set up in 2002 to support the Albanian community to settle with dignity in UK. In 2012, we, for the first time in our history, we were approached by the police in Croydon, and they said, we have a large number of looked-after children that we don't know why they are here, we don't know their behaviour, we don't understand on how to work with them, and no one was in the area to have the speciality to work with them and understand them. So in the monitor, you have the figures from our work on since then. What we were able to do at that time, we never had set up a project from top down. All our projects were done by identifying the needs, working with people to make the change that they wanted. For the first time, we said, what is happening? We don't know. So we consulted the young people in the area. We consulted the mainstream providers, the schools. We consulted the police. We consulted foster carers and social workers. And there was no understanding of the Albanians to the society where they live in. And there was no understanding of the mainstream providers on how to work in with the Albanian-speaking community. There were lots of things going cross-border, so they thought the country is really racist towards them. And the young people said, you know, or the foster carers said, the young people manifest racist, you know, language. And there was a lack of understanding in both of the ways. So we decided to do our work. But how do we work? What are our, you know, what are the ethos or the core values of our work? We start from the basis that no one knows everything. So that's why we need to work together. Existing join-up work doesn't work from the top. And that's why lots of young people, you know, really fail. Good partnership have to have honesty and respect as core of the relationship. And sometimes grassroots organizations are asked to do everything. And we said, okay, whose responsibility is for this looked after children that are living in London? Is it the central government? Is it the local government? Is the Albanian government? Is the local authority? Is the third sector? Is it individuals? Well, we were all naive at that time. We said, well, everyone, it's everyone's responsibility and we should play ours. So we started our journey.
So what we thought would be most useful to talk about today from that background is what we run now a service on a Saturday, having realised that there wasn't shared responsibility for these young people and they were falling through the nets across the board in terms of social services, housing, education, but most importantly, legal advice. We've set up a drop-in unfunded on Saturdays. And what we've done is taken our learning from that drop-in to say what are the key characteristics of the transition to adulthood for young Albanian unaccompanied minors. Now, the first thing is the insecurity of their immigration status. That permeates absolutely everything that they do. So they won't be able to quote you the figure that's there, that they've got a 0.5% chance of securing refugee status at first decision, but they know how many of their friends have been re-trafficked or deported or ended up in detention centres or had to disappear on the ground. And that's their daily reality. And what that means is there's a loss of a certain future for them. I mean, we've heard that again and again today. But I have a real contrast. I've got a 19 and a 15-year-old daughter, and I spend sort of 7-8 hours at Gibraltar, and I go home to my daughters, and they're planning their UCAS forms and their summer jobs and their trips to Germany and their school trips, and they're planning their driving tests. None of that is open to those young people. They can't take a driving test, can't go on a school trip, can't plan for university. So the whole of their future is on hold. None of those plans that are part of young people's daily lives are open to them. And that leaves them with a backdrop of massive anxiety. And we do now sort of breathing exercises with young people partway through the session so that we can talk to them about how to get back to sleep at night, how to cope with feelings of self-harm and suicidal ideation. There's a sense of real hopelessness. So Shpresa are amazing. You have a group of mother tongue Albanian speaking women who are mothers and aunts to these young people. And when they come at 14 and 15, they engage them. But at 17, it's really hard to keep them engaged because they know what's ahead. So we lose them. They say, what's the point? I was doing really well at school. I've done the training. I volunteer. But I'm going to end up on the streets. I'm going to end up deported. So what's the point? And there's a dread of each letter and each phone call. Sometimes when I phone the young person for the first time and they don't have my phone number, they'll be like, yeah, yeah, what is it, what is it? Or they'll say, I've brought a letter in from the Home Office because I'm too frightened to open it and to find out what it means. This has been mentioned again and again today, that's massively isolating. We see young people who will not go back to school or will not engage with their peer groups. They'd rather become really isolated, become really withdrawn because of the complexity of explaining why they can't be part of mainstream civil society. And I just wanted to give an example. On the 14th of October, we saw 14 young people, all of which were urgent. One was a woman, a traffic jam woman, who were able to find a solicitor for quickly. The other 13 we could do very little for. We had a box of tissues at the beginning. We got through that by the third young person. At Shpresa, they feel safe to really talk about what they're going through. And the first three young people were just crying because they missed their mums. And then the fifth one, partway through telling us what he was going through, said, I'm going to be sick and have to go out and vomit and then come back. And I just wonder how, in an advanced Western capitalist society, that can just be fine. As well as insecure immigration status, these young people are regularly disbelieved. I'm not going to read you out there, but that's guidance around how complex it is to communicate with young people cross-culture who are extremely traumatised. And we had the fantastic example of the film that the young people have made of what a Home Office interview is like. And I'm not sure if anyone has read The Heart of the Matter, Assessing Credibility Guidance. It's fantastic. And I've never heard it be adhered to in a Home Office interview, never. And after I'd read that guidance preparing for this, I just picked the first two most recent cases of determinations for young people at Shpresa. And one child who was trafficked when he was 14, over a year later, was disbelieved because he couldn't remember whether it was his father or he who had first gone to the police. And when I was talking to him to respond to the issues and the determination, he said, at my screening interview, I said it was me. At my substantive interview, I said it was my father. I actually don't remember who it was, but between us, we decided to go to the police. I don't know who did. And then the second young person, the judge made a huge issue out of the fact that he didn't know what his sister's boyfriend and his sister's boyfriend's parents' occupation were. So I went upstairs. My daughter's 15 and she was upstairs, same age as this young person. And I said, what do your three best friends' fathers do? She knew one was dead. She knew one worked in the same department as her own father. She had no idea what the other one's father did. She thought the mum was a receptionist in school, but she might have been a teaching assistant. This is a child who's not traumatised at all. And she didn't know that. The expectation that this kid would know that. And that is not a central aspect of his claim, but he was completely discredited on that basis. And they're not just disbelieved by Home Office officials. I mean, I won't read through the list, but we had one young guy say to us, oh, my foster carer tells me, some foster carers are fantastic, don't get me wrong, but we had one young guy say, my foster carer constantly tells me, don't get settled because you're Albanian. They all lie and they're all sent home. There are fantastic teachers and fantastic police that we work alongside, but there are also some who say all the Albanians are economic migrants. They're all economic migrants. So they're seen as potential gang members, potential drug dealers, potential traffickers, and they're expected to fail. And that young boy I'm quoting there, he had to represent himself, age 17, in front of an immigration judge and a Home Office official, and that's what he said. But he was disbelieved on everything. His claim just destroyed his credibility, the determination. I think other people have said the absence of family is absolutely critical. And I think because we talk all the time about unaccompanied minors, this kind of term, which actually doesn't acknowledge, you are talking about children from the age of 12 who are here without parents. And many young people are too scared to make contact with their parents, so they have no idea whether they are safe. Recently, I was talking to a 19-year-old who's just had a negative NRM decision, conclusive grounds decision, and we were looking at what had happened since. And he was saying, oh, a few months ago, armed police came to my house. My gran and my sister was there. They stuffed cloth in my sister's mouth. And he's normally a really happy-go-lucky young person. He got very choked. So I said, oh, it must be very hard to be facing return on that basis. And he looked at me like, you're an idiot, and said, my sister is getting cloth put in her mouth, and I am safe. How do you think I feel? So there is the shame and the guilt about being safe when your family are back home facing that. Foster care is short term. Some people have had amazing foster parents, but often even when they want to keep the children on, they're financially dependent on the income. So although they will keep in touch with some of the young people, have them back for meals, let them stay in their houses when they're on holiday, the reality of even if it's a very positive relationship, it's a short term relationship. And all their relationships are precarious. They are moved from foster care and from semi-independent accommodation at exceptionally short notice. So even if they have developed some good relationships, they are extremely precarious. And what I always think of is their networks are so small. When you go to court with them, I'll say, is there anyone who can come to court with you? It's like, well, I haven't told my girlfriend. She thinks I'm Spanish. No, I haven't told anyone else. No, actually, can Shpresa find me somebody to come with me? Their networks are tiny. And this young person, this 16-year-old, again, I was preparing a statement and I stupidly said, do you miss your mum? He just looked at me and said, of course I miss my mum. She did everything for me and now I'm here alone. Education, and I won't go into details, but education, you know, in other areas that I work, education should be protective. It's not always. Some of them do exceptionally well at school, but know they are going to fall off the cliff edge at 18. What's going to happen? What's the point? But also, time and time again, immigration judges say, oh, you're doing well at school. You'll be fine. You're very resilient. You can go home. So it's actually used against them, their capacity to engage in the system. And this young man, he utterly exceptional young man. Within a year of arriving in this country, he got A stars at A at maths and further maths. But he said to me, what's the point? I never will go to university. And work, I mean, I don't think that's come out so much today, but nearly every young person we see is working without protection, without minimum wage, without access to health and safety legislation, to pay debts to agents or traffickers. And if they don't pay those debts, their fear is for their family. So it's non-optional as far as they're concerned, to pay lawyers, to live when they're over 18 because they're destitute, or to pay debts that they've accrued over their journeys here, to people within their own community. And that 17-year-old didn't know that legal aid existed. He paid his lawyer £1,000 for the initial application, and he was referred to us by another young person when he was trying to raise £3,000 for the appeal. And there's nothing more chilling than at the end of a day of my work to meet somebody in the evening to do a statement and have a 16-year-old turn up in construction clothes who's clearly been working on a building site in East London for the whole day. Insecure housing. I won't go on because I want you to hear Lily now talking about, but you know what their housing options are. Lily's now going to talk about a case study. But just to say, we feel primarily these young people have no physical security and no emotional security. And this 17-year-old, he came to do me a favour. I work with an organisation in York, and we were having unaccompanied minors for the first time in York, and he trained the foster carers. And when he described his first night in foster care, and that's just an extract of what he said, the room was completely silent. And I thought I was quite a good trainer, but the feedback that we got from that training session was that kids should go into it professionally. He literally had everybody understanding everything that he said. Sorry.
Now I have to speed. It's 2 minutes we have. Well, we had to discuss which case to bring in today. So I thought I'll put one from the top of my head now and one that is, you know, what we discussed. So we worked with one of the colleges that called us for support, and is when the joined up work, you know, works well, the difference is great. So we worked with John Ruskin College for 3 years. I started with a year where everyone was coming late, didn't come to school, had no motivation. At the third year, we had the president of the school and looked after child that was Albanian. We had 4 of the students were, you know, head of the years. But that is just one. Well, I want to share with you Arbor's story. Arbor was referred to us by his foster care to have English classes. So he had a foster care that he couldn't communicate with. He had a room and he felt lonely because he couldn't ask even for bread or water and didn't know how to behave. Well, he needed an immigration lawyer, he needed a school place, he needed to know how to travel, he needed to know the rights and responsibilities. whose responsibility was this? And for us, when I met him for the first time, he was, you know, underrepresenting himself. He looked younger than his age. He looked ill. And he couldn't complain. So what he said, you know, you've got a bit of, you know, toothache. And he didn't know what to do, and he didn't want to bother the foster carers. And I said, well, it's their responsibility. They need to take you to GP, they need to take you to dentist. And they did so, they registered him. The next day, he went for the appointment on his own. Two of his molars were, you know, removed. And then he thought that he will have an implant. And when I phoned up the dentist, he said, no, we're not going to implant, there is no funding for it. And look at his face. I still have it in my, you know, in my dreams that, you know, he said, look, I've got all this big, you know, space and my own, you know, his confidence just dropped. He started to come to Espresso every day. He had Espresso office to stay just behind because we couldn't talk every single minute with him. And we worked. And then he went to the park and he learned English. 6 months. It took the social services and the foster care to decide whose responsibility is to find a college place for him. 6 months. He was walking on that park. And he said, well, the only friend that I had is when a dog ran to me and I could cuddle it. And that was, you know, Arbus' story. I asked the foster care, can you send him to the good lawyer? And I gave a list of firms. And she said, no, 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 these are too far. So I'm going to go next door. There is one in Stratford. So he took, you know, they took him there. What happened? He got refused. The appeal was dismissed. This young person had to go, you know, in a black market, had to disappear. Well, I spoke to him and I said, listen, what you have, it's very limited. You'll be leaving and the risk will be greater. You're sleeping on the floors, you're sleeping with other people, you will work, but other people will use you. And he said, well, at least in this country, I'll have this. If I go back, the only people I know are what are the friends of my father, and they can't protect me because he couldn't protect me, you know, when I was in Albania. You know, he really punished me, and he lived in an abusive, you know, relationship. Mum and him were abused all the time, and he couldn't get support. If I was able to move and leave that country from age 11, I would have done so. But there was no one to help me, nor my uncles, nor my neighbours, no one in my town was able to help me. No one is going to help me now. So for Ervis, we did something really, really good. You know, he went to Esme surgery. Every month they do a surgery. They are, you know, two mad people that look at the papers and translate it and find some wonderful people like Catherine, David, lots of name it, you know, lots of good solicitors that do good, Chris. They do good, wonderful stuff for young people. And they got a good solicitor. And we took him there. And the first time, you know, the appeal, you know, the fresh application was refused. And then 3 weeks ago, we've got an email and say, okay, well, the fresh, you know, the appeal has been allowed, so a fresh application could continue. Well, I was so happy. But then what had happened to Ervis, he had gone to prison because he was traveling, or, you know, he was driving with a false, you know, ID with no insurance going to work. And we don't know what is going to go.
So for us, just one second, just our question is, how does this happen? We're probably the sixth richest country in the world, excluding tax havens, and we've got people like this guy who's deaf in one ear from the beatings, who ended up on the streets and in prison and who is not protected. We've got 17-year-olds going before immigration judges with 40 years' experience on their own. There's some kind of extreme othering going on where we see these children as different from our own children and grandchildren, brothers and sisters. There is something about the fact that Albania particularly is little known, little understood. People are fleeing non-state agents. Nobody has any understanding of that. But every young person in the asylum system, we don't treat them like children and young people first. We treat them like problems. We treat them as, you know, economic migrants. We treat them as aliens. And I think for everybody in this room, and particularly for everyone working daily with unaccompanied minors, it's how to get somebody to see them as a child and as a young person first. Thanks very much.
And I just want to add, becoming adult has been a trampoline for all the young people to express their voices, to grow with the project and feel that other people, they are same as other people. It's not just against them. So I think for the first time, they felt that they had shared issues. It's not just Albanian that blade, you know.
Yeah, it's been a fantastic project.
Thank you.
social policy, and she's part of the Becoming Other project. And Jenny has done also ethnographic work in Italy and Rome, looking at unaccompanied minors in transitions. Do you need help?
Is it this one?
I've got a bit of a cough, and after watching our Prime Minister deliver a disastrous speech at the Conservative Party conference, given that she's my nemesis, I wanted to come prepared, so I'm just going to... It's not gin. It's, Okay, right. Oh, I'm a bit overwhelmed. Right, focus. Young people's transitions to Italy. So as we talked about earlier, my research kind of focused on the UK and Italy, and I was trying to kind of bring some added value to the main UK-based project by looking at how there are different opportunities in Italy compared to the UK. And the reason I chose those countries is because Italy has quite a different system to the UK, and the main difference being that Italy, like France, Lord Dubs mentioned this earlier, has a system for unaccompanied minors being able to extend their leave post 18 under certain quite strict conditions, but it's there. And the other big difference is that in Italy, unlike the UK, there is a system for legalising your status as a non-asylum seeking unaccompanied minor. So when I was reading about these different contexts, I was kind of thinking, well, we keep talking about the common European asylum system, and throughout the refugee crisis in Europe, you know, it's been very much approached as a European response. We have, you know, even though unaccompanied minors aren't subject to the Dublin III regulations, which mean that they can be sent back to their country of origin into the European Union, there is still a sense that the standards for unaccompanied minors are kind of, in some senses, standardised across EU countries. And that's not the case. It's not the case in terms of the, like I say, the pathways to legality or legalising your status, hence the non-asylum seeking pathway possibility in Italy and France. But it's also not the same in terms of acceptance rates for asylum-seeking young people. So to give an example, in Italy, if you're from Afghanistan, you're pretty much guaranteed to get humanitarian leave, whereas in the UK, as we've heard, you're very unlikely to get asylum as an Afghan. So these are just to give a kind of glimpse of some of the differences. And the other reason why Italy was of interest is because of this important population of so-called missing unaccompanied minors. And we know, obviously, from work that Nando and others have done, that a lot of these young people who are classed as missing and often portrayed in policy terms as disappearing and being kind of taken by bogeymen and women into trafficking circles, actually a lot of the time they're kind of exercising agency and pursuing their own migratory projects, which I'm going to talk a little bit about now. So the research questions were kind of coming at the issue of migration and youth studies alongside social policy. So I was interested in how unaccompanied young people understand and interact with different types of statutory and non-statutory welfare as they become adult, and also how their interactions with statutory and non-statutory forms of welfare kind of shape their well-being and future trajectories. And finally, do these different welfare setups that we see in Italy and the UK, are they more kind of favourable to certain migratory projects than others, whether that's on the basis of work or sanctuary or what have you? So some theoretical reflections. So I've worked with Nando and Elaine for a while, so I was very influenced by Elaine's work on futures and the importance of futures to subjective understandings of well-being. But also, how do we understand well-being and how it intersects with welfare? Often, social policy research is over here, and kind of refugee studies and migration studies is over here. But one of the interesting things about becoming adult for this group is at the age of 18, often they find themselves moving from a protected system as child refugees with various protections to suddenly being cast into the kind of general welfare system that is also accessible or not to certain categories of citizens. So I really wanted to try and bridge that literature. Just an interesting quote by Diane Sainsbury that kind of shows that there's been a dearth of research in this area. There's an important interplay between welfare regimes, forms of immigration, and immigration policy regimes in producing distinctive patterns of immigrants' social rights across countries.
In the literature on international migration, social rights have been discussed mostly in terms of formal entitlements. The discussion has tended to present social rights at the particular point in time rather than to adopt a longitudinal perspective. So by looking at informal as well as formal welfare, statutory welfare, and also adopting this longitudinal perspective, that's what I kind of tried to plug into. My methodology was informed by ideas around narratives and storytelling, which is something we've talked a lot about today and yesterday. So this just gives a kind of glimpse of what I mean by this. This was a picture by a young Egyptian in Rome, and he says, "This is a picture of me and my cousin. He's in Italy and I'm in Egypt, and we're talking on the phone. I'm asking him, so how's Italy? And he says, oh, it's great. Yeah, there's work, money. There's all you could ever want. You have to come to Italy. And then I come to Italy and it's not like that. So this picture's about that, and it's called The Illusion of Italy. So we don't have time to go into this now, but it's just about that question that's come up about collective migration projects as well as individual migration projects, questions around hope and aspirations. And I really, was it... Ida, who made the point, is this a crisis or is this a movement? And I think that's something that really captures a theme in this conference that I'm really going to take away. It's kind of echoed in this picture, which shows a wall in a youth centre in Rome, where various Afghans who were transiting through just posted their pictures, and it became this kind of organic display. And I think it captures the idea of migration projects in the sense of this kind of brotherhood idea that was articulated. But also, I think, thinking again about the importance of family, and as we've discussed, how individual life projects are also tied into familial survival strategies and livelihood strategies as well. I'll scan over this because I don't have much time, but why use storytelling as a research method and an epistemological framework in policy-focused research? Everyone in my department in social policy thinks I'm a complete hippie madwoman, and I love that, Eddie, you started your presentation with your list of academic publications and said, yes, I've done participatory research, and I'm talking about post-colonial studies, but take me seriously. And we've talked a lot about the ethics of participatory research, but one thing I really wanted to stress is that, as well as ethics, we're talking about 10,000 missing children. This is a statistic that we hear a lot in policy terms in the EU. You can't find out about that group's experiences without doing participatory research, without doing qualitative research. So I think, as well as the ethical obligation to do participatory research and arts-based research, we also have to see it as a way of getting really high-quality data. So I just wanted to stress that point. That's the same point, just on a different slide, because I did this at 1 a.m. So this is the fieldwork, basically. I spent about 9 months in Italy in one centre, which was for where there were a quarter of the population were unaccompanied minors transiting through. In the 9 months I was there, there were 45,000 individual migrants who transited through Rome, and a quarter of them were unaccompanied minors, just to give you an idea. Again, statistics are a bit... they don't really represent that situation, official statistics. And I also did an ethnography of a formal reception centre for young people staying in Italy and interviews. And then I did similar research in the UK. And all in all, as well as the arts and participatory research, I had about 50 interviews. What did I find? There's a lot, Elaine and I have written on this, but the EU policy discourse talks a lot about life project planning. So this idea of stories and narratives and futures is very much built in to the kind of formal policy framework and futures planning framework for this group. So I wanted to kind of turn that around and say, well, what does life projects mean to these young people? This is what the kind of policy guidance says. But what, when you ask young people about, well, what are their kind of projects? What are their migratory projects, their life projects? What do they say? And their kind of four main objectives centered around study, family reunification, relationships, work, and safety. And as we've discussed, I like Nassim's concept of layering. You know, all of these things layer and intersect. So I just wanted to talk you through some case studies of how young people in Italy have navigated these different objectives in the Italian system. So first case study, Miriam from Eritrea. So her primary objective was to reunite with her family in Sweden. She was travelling through, she was 17, with her 10-year-old brother, and they spent 3 months in a squat in Rome. Just to kind of, this quote brings out some of the questions around statutory welfare versus kind of informal welfare. So this is a note from my field diary. So I ask Beata, who's an Italian volunteer at the squat centre, what she makes of the minors staying at the squat. There was some trouble a while ago, she says, where some arrogant adults made the kids sleep outside for 4 days. She explains that the kids don't want to go and stay in the new Red Cross centre because even though it's great, there's no bed bugs and loads of space and clean beds and it's all new, it's further from the trafficanti, the smugglers, and they can't do business there. They're also worried they'll get reported. We discussed the fact that they only went there the one night of the knifing, but on the condition Ella would give them a lift back the next day. Oh, and we'd miss them, the volunteer adds. As we sit there, a police car passes through the narrow street over the chalk drawings I did with the kids earlier. Beata grabs 10-year-old Omar and hugs him close so he doesn't run out in front of the car. His sister's out at the Colosseum. When she gets back later, I let her use my phone to call their uncle in Sudan, who's sending them money. And the next quote's just to follow up with their journey when they were in Germany. And now they're in Sweden and having a great time. And it was very problematic for me kind of arriving in Italy with all of my kind of orientalist British assumptions and kind of it's being like, oh, my God, this is a 10-year-old child and it's sleeping on the bloody street and there's bed bugs and you're building, like, boiling a massive pan of pasta there with boiling hot water and there's a child. And it was just very difficult for me to kind of work out why these kids weren't going to the Red Cross camp. But obviously it was about questions of access to knowledge, questions of, well, what services, what welfare did they want? Maybe they wanted a trip to the Colosseum. Maybe they needed some support on finding out which smuggler could get them to Sweden most cheaply, etc. And all of these other factors. So it's just that question of, well, who is best placed to provide certain services to young people and their own kind of subjective ideas of that. This is just a point about family and relationships as well, to show how you can use kind of artistic methods to kind of bring out some of these issues. So this was with Stefania, who's from the Maxi. We did quite a lot of visits to the museum with the young people, and we encouraged them to draw museums of themselves, kind of what's important to you, what's in your museum. And this was a young person from Albania who'd been in a centre for 3 months and never mentioned that he had a brother. And then in his museum of himself, his brother appears, and his brother actually did appear also in Rome a month later. So it's just a point about, again, arts methods aren't just hippy-dippy. They can tell us really important things about young people. And just on that point, this was another project we did, and it's all in this lovely booklet, which is in Italian because I didn't have time to translate it. But, you know, an image speaks 1,000 words or whatever it is. I'll try and put a translation on the website at some point. But this was a young person who kept disappearing from the centre, and he was on his final warning. He was going to get chucked out of this centre in Italy if he didn't kind of behave himself and stay in after dark. And he found the idea was to transform one of the objects in the museum into something that was important to you. And Ahmed ended up transforming this shield into a door and then going into a kind of diatribe about how, in his words, where I'm from, the doors of my friends are always open. And he carved the names of his friends onto these doors. This is Mansour and Ahmed. And he said, and here, you shut me in after 8 o'clock. I'm 17, for God's sake. Like, what's going on? And actually, that really started a dialogue in the centre about, and actually they extended the curfew to 9 o'clock. So it was a small thing, but just in terms of, again, showing how these methods can work. Quickly, Bangladesh, people want to work. And in Italy, there are opportunities to do that that there aren't in the UK. So for some young people, including young people from Bangladesh and Albania and Egypt, where there are established migrant populations, especially in cities in the north of Italy, actually, for some young people, they have opportunities there that they wouldn't have if they came to the UK, because they don't claim asylum. And if they come under the age of 18 and they can get a job contract, they are able to stay. And that leads to situations of exploitation and a lot of really problematic circumstances. But it is also a pathway which is helping thousands of young people every year. And in Italy at the moment, there's a bit of a movement to kind of channel all unaccompanied minors through the protection system, a bit like in the UK. And we've discussed a lot about this question around asylum versus economic migration, and I think it's a really tricky one, because on one hand you want to recognise the protection needs of young people, but how do you do that in a way that doesn't take away one of very few pathways to legality for young people who don't fit into that very narrow idea of asylum? Finding jobs are hard. Study, I'm just going to skip through that. This just gives an idea of some of the problematic kind of issues around that pathway to legality through a work contract. And then just finally, one of the case studies, which I think really highlights the differences between the UK and the Italian systems, and I'm trying to theorise this for my PhD in terms of what I'm calling, very drawing on stereotypes, colander welfare versus iron rod welfare, which is the idea that in Italy, you know, the formal statutory welfare system is full of holes, and the informal sector, welfare sector, kind of leans into that in certain contexts, and there are advantages and disadvantages of that. But it's easier to be illegal. People kept saying it's easier to be illegal in Italy. In Italy, there are papers as well. It's easier to get papers. Work is difficult, but there are advantages to Italy. Whereas in the UK, everything's done according to an iron rod version of welfare. If you're on the inside, here are your rights. You've got a flat. You're on it. You're great. Not to say that there aren't problems, but in terms of a kind of European comparison. And there were a few Afghans in my research who had actually migrated back to Italy from the UK after becoming all appeal rights exhausted because they... oh, Theresa May. because they'd calculated that it was easier to live irregularly in Italy. And this was some of the rationale that some of the young people gave for making that trip. You know, I was scared. And it was quite striking the way some of them described this flight from the UK to Italy. And some of them had moved straight back to Italy, and some of them had been deported to Afghanistan and then come back and got papers in Italy. And they really described this fear of deportation and detention as a flight. It was almost like they were describing their flight from the UK in the same terms of persecution as they were fleeing Afghanistan, for example. It was very striking. But they also noted the differences in the two different setups. So in conclusion, in Italy, there are some advantages to not being strict about the rules. So young people forge various pathways through the mixed welfare economy, which centre mainly around work, study, family reunification, safety, and in some cases, criminality and exploitation. Different trajectories are shaped by a range of factors, but there are notable trends according to the country of origin. And interestingly, even though it's in no way a representative sample, the Egyptians, all of the Egyptians I spoke to in Italy said they were there for work, whereas all of the Egyptians who I spoke to in the UK said they were here fleeing the Muslim Brotherhood. So it's again, it's like, how are different narratives in different contexts either performed, or is it that refugees from Italy are actually coming to the UK because they know that the protection that they could get as refugees would be better in the UK than Italy? We don't know. It's another big question. But there we go. Implications for policy and practice, finally. Common European asylum system, How do young refugees and migrants understand welfare? And in the UK, where we're increasingly seeing this rapprochement between the Home Office and every public service, whether it's the NHS, schools, universities, etc., you know, this is a real, this iron rod is becoming more and more strictly wielded. Who's best placed to support unaccompanied minors if we think about kind of the welfare mix? And yeah, that's it. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much for all these wonderful presentations. And we can open the floor to questions before going to the final panel discussion and leave, losing all the audience. Yes, that's very important actually. So there is a food and drink reception all free at 6 o'clock. So does anyone have questions?
I've got a question. It's not a question, it's just, I don't know if you can help me with this. You know, because the government of Afghanistan, they want people to come back to the country. Obviously, you see the current situation is not stable still. According to Home Office, Kabul is the safest place where all the Afghans should go after when they turn 18 if they feel very exhausted. And the government, I know it's probably for their own benefit, they want money or something. I don't know about this, maybe that's the case. But is there any organization or anyone who could talk to the government to say that, why are you being so stupid? Yeah.
You want to take it? have enough facts to be able to start more strongly writing such statements. It's been quite a few years, right, that the government here says that even if Afghanistan isn't safe, for example, Kabul is safe. So if you can't go to Kandahar or Nangarhar, at least you can go back to Kabul if you're Afghan. And now we start to have more and more data to be able to counter that. Just look at the number of attacks in Kabul versus the rest of Afghanistan, looking at the number of civilian casualties. So there's enough UN reporting on that now that I think we're in a very good place to be able to show that Kabul is actually one of the least safe areas, one of the most dangerous areas of all of Afghanistan. So again, I think it's about just making sure that that evidence makes it to the government, but there is enough evidence to show again. And again, I think there are statements like the ones the UN has made this year about Afghanistan being a country in conflict, no longer being a post-conflict country, that we need to keep rehashing and reusing as much as we can. Let's use the UN whenever we can, kind of thing. And I think it's really their responsibility to stand up to such things.
Yeah, we can take a couple of other questions. And then, yeah.
I'm just interested in, everything's been really interesting all day, but in relation to Italy and the work permit that you were mentioning, is it any different to the UK and whether that provided the level of stability for the young people? Just thinking to the talk earlier by Roberta about it, like a suspended stability, because you have to have a job to maintain that job, so it's not necessarily long term. If you felt that was a kind of how that works operationally, how young people felt in relation to security and a lot of the issues that have been talked about earlier around kind of mental health and anxiety.
Yeah.
Yeah. My name is really a comment from an independent Nigeria a week on a campaign of young people. I work in a child asylum and 16 plus team in Solio, and we work with many Panacombana asylum seeking young people from Albania. And the problem we've got is almost impossible to get them leave to remain in this country, following the comment that the foreign secretary from Albania made back in 2015, saying that Albania is a safe country. So that has given our to the Home Office to say, right, you can go back, even if you are in fear of persecution from non-state actors. There is some sort of assumption from the UK government that you can go back easily to Afghanistan and to Albania, and you can be protected by the state. We know that's not true. I mean, that's dealing with a young person who is turned 18, has become in Solomon, the approach we've taken is we support young people under the leaving care legislation until they are 21, irrespective of the immigration situation. But with the new Immigration Act coming into force very soon and the new statutory guidance that has been produced, it's almost impossible for social services to carry on supporting young people, keep it undertake a human rights assessment and conclude that because of what your government is saying, you can easily go back to your country of origin. So, you talked about the issue of protection being a kind of problem for everybody, but I think the Albanian government has made it easier for us as practitioners on the ground.
Yeah, do you want to quickly just
maybe we could talk to your office, because we're trying to gather together some evidence to show that there is insufficient data for that chat. And we've got some documents that might be useful for you, these panel officers that are representing young people, because clearly it's a huge problem. The success rate for Albania in particular is torturing. But it might be useful for you to speak to me about your afterwards.
So just a question about...
I think it's a really interesting point, and everything Roberta was saying earlier really resonated with the experience of that group. Although the one difference I would say, and again, I don't know how much that relates to the experience in America, but a lot of the young people who fell into that category of getting those permits, so from countries such as Albania, Egypt, Bangladesh, for them, I don't think most of them saw their futures in Italy necessarily. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a question of coming and working and getting some money and getting some skills and education, perhaps, or even perhaps kind of getting a difficult family situation for a while, and then going back later on. So I think it's a slightly different phenomenon, and you know, and this is where I think that kind of voluntary forced migration continuum is really important, because for them, for most of them, there is this sense that they will go home, and that's part of their migration project as well. So I think, yes, it's experienced as precarious because the permit only lasts 2 years and is conditional on having a work contract. So it is experienced as precarious, yeah. But it's also, yeah, it's not, I think, for some of them, and again, I'm not generalising, but it's also understood as that, and they shape their migration project around the precarious nature of that, or time-limited nature of that, need to remain, if that makes sense.
Okay. So we can leave the other questions and discussion like to the end with a glass of wine, and then we can just open the floor to the final panel discussion.